The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Negotiation Method, Prepare, Anchor, and Trade. Well Topic Introduction. At 8:17 on a Wednesday evening, you are staring at a renewal quote on a laptop screen while the room behind you is still busy with ordinary life. A message from a supplier sits unanswered. A manager wants a quick decision. A client wants one small change before morning. Somewhere else, a landlord is naming a higher rent. A mechanic is explaining a repair bill. And a teammate is asking for more time than the calendar seems willing to give. None of these moments looks dramatic from the outside. But each one contains the same quiet pressure. Someone asks for one thing. Someone else can only say yes, no, or maybe if the terms change. That is the world of negotiation. It happens in homes, offices, factories, inboxes, video calls, and procurement rooms. It shows up when you argue about subscription prices, salary, scope, deadlines, vendor renewals, chores, or who absorbs the inconvenience when plans collide. You may not think of these moments as negotiations, but they are. Anytime two sides need an agreement and do not begin with the same answer, negotiation has already begun. This book treats negotiation as a practical skill, not a personality contest. That distinction matters. Beginners often assume good negotiators are simply bolder, sharper, or more charming than everyone else. In reality, negotiation is usually about preparation, clarity, and timing. It is about knowing what matters most, what can move, what cannot, and what happens if no deal is reached. Once you understand that, the whole subject becomes less mysterious. It stops looking like a test of nerve and starts looking like a decision under pressure. Two ideas will recur throughout the chapters. The first is BATNA, which stands for the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. In plain language, it is your backup plan if the deal falls through. The stronger your BATNA, the more calmly you can evaluate an offer. The second is objective criteria, which are neutral standards both sides can inspect, such as market rates, policies, benchmarks, specifications, or comparable pricing. When a conversation turns personal, objective criteria can bring it back to something concrete. That is important because many negotiations fail in the same way. People begin by stating positions, not interests. A position is what someone says they want. An interest is the reason underneath it. A client says the fee is too high. A supplier says the price has to rise. A manager says the deadline cannot move. Those are our positions. But the real issue may be budget pressure, uncertainty, staffing, approval rules, risk, or timing. When you hear only the position, the conversation can harden. When you begin to understand the interest, the set of possible solutions usually gets wider. That wider view is what this audiobook helps you build. It shows you how to prepare before the meeting starts, how to read the other side without guessing, and how to keep a conversation from collapsing into noise. You learn why the first number matters, why silence can be useful, why a concession should never be accidental, and why a deal that looks good on paper can still be wrong if it sits below your real alternative. You also learn why the same principles apply whether you are discussing a salary, a service contract, a repair estimate, a team deadline, or a multi-line commercial renewal. The modern setting makes these skills more important, not less. Work is faster, contracts are more complex, and a single conversation can include price, timing, quality, support, and risk all at once. A vendor may point to rising costs while the market is moving in the opposite direction. A buyer may focus on the headline price while the real savings depend on payment terms or service levels. A team may argue about who should do the work when the deeper issue is which project gets priority. Negotiation is the art of seeing those hidden layers without losing sight of the immediate decision. You will also see that negotiation is not only about getting more. It is about shaping an agreement that both sides can actually live with. That means there is a difference between a quick answer and a durable answer. A quick answer may end the discomfort. A durable answer survives contact with reality. It can hold up when the invoice arrives, when the deadline changes, when the scope expands, or when someone later asks, "What exactly did we agree to?" Good negotiation gives the agreement a structure strong enough to last. Along the way, you will notice a recurring pattern. The most effective negotiators do not rush to force a conclusion. They slow the conversation just enough to find the real issue. They ask clean questions. They listen for the gap between the stated demand and the underlying concern. They use facts to anchor the discussion when opinion starts to drift. And they understand that confidence comes not from pressure, but from options. That is the promise of this book. It does not ask you to become aggressive, manipulative, or theatrical. It asks you to become prepared, alert, and deliberate. It shows you how to think before you speak, how to separate what you need from what you merely want, and how to recognize when a proposed deal is better than your alternative and when it is not. By the time you reach the later chapters, negotiation should feel less like a mystery and more like a method you can repeat. For now, the essential question is simple. When the other side says something different from what you hope to hear, what do you do next? The answer begins with preparation, and it begins here. End of introduction. Market Price Index reporting from the first half of 2025 provides one concrete example of how objective standards can surface mismatches in procurement conversations. Negotiation is a skill that shows up when you ask a question and the other person gives you a different answer. You feel it when you try to set a fair rent, when you push back on a repair bill, when you decide whether a subscription is worth keeping, when you and colleagues split chores, and when you talk about salary. You also feel it in quieter places, like client pricing, vendor renewals, procurement decisions, scope changes, and the day-to-day bargaining inside a team over time and priorities. At its simplest, negotiation is reaching a mutually acceptable agreement. It is not a perfect outcome, and it is not instant harmony. It is an arrangement both sides can live with because it beats their real alternative if nothing gets agreed. This is education, not individualized financial advice. When you are new at negotiation, one reason it feels hard is that it can seem like a contest of personality. The practical core is more specific. You keep asking one question. What does each side need? What does each side want? And what can each side trade to get there? When you can answer that, negotiation stops looking like a mystery and starts looking like an exchange of constraints. Negotiating chores is not only asking for help, it is trading time, fairness, and routine. Negotiating a contract is not only discussing price, it is trading delivery timing, risk, service level, and flexibility. As those hidden needs come into focus, the range of workable solutions usually widens. That is why positions and interests matter. A position is the stated demand or offer, the number, the rule, the refusal, the request. An interest is the reason underneath it. Someone may ask for a lower rent, but the deeper interest may be predictability over the next year. A client may push for a lower fee, while the real interest may be budget control, internal approval, or keeping room for other spending. Positions are easier to hear. Interests take work to uncover. But interests are where the trade space lives, especially in pricing and scope talks. If one side cares most about price and the other side cares most about timing, flexibility, or service quality, you often move beyond a rigid tug of war over a single number. Negotiation also is not just about splitting the difference. It has two jobs at once: value creation and value claiming. Value creation means finding ways to make the overall deal larger or better for both sides through smart trades. Value claiming means making sure the agreement does not give away more than necessary and reflects a fair share of the value that got created. When people hear win-win, they sometimes imagine a perfect split. That is not the real idea. A win-win deal is one both sides prefer to their alternatives. The deal might favor one side more on price while the other side gets more value through timing, risk reduction, or convenience. The point is not symmetry. The point is that both sides would rather say yes than walk away. Once you see value creation and claiming, negotiation styles make more sense. A collaborative approach looks for shared gains and expands the number of workable options. A competitive approach treats the exchange more like leverage and focuses on holding the line. An adaptive approach shifts between modes as the situation changes. None of these styles is automatically right. Hard bargaining can help when the issue is narrow, the terms are mostly fixed, or the other side is using pressure and may respond only to firmness. Interest-based negotiation tends to create more value when several issues are on the table, when the relationship matters, or when one side can trade something low cost for something high value. The best negotiators do not worship one style. They choose what fits the facts and constraints in front of them. There is also a historical thread behind this emphasis on interests. Over time, scholarship and practice pushed back on the idea that the best deals come from digging only into positions. The argument is that you get better outcomes when you understand why those positions exist. This shift does not remove toughness. It refines it by treating firmness as wasted effort when you do not understand the reasons behind demands, and as incomplete when you understand the reasons but still refuse to protect your own interests. Modern negotiation keeps that balance, using pressure when it fits the tool, while treating understanding as the map of the terrain. A big part of that map is objective criteria. These are neutral standards both sides can use when the conversation risks turning personal. A market price can be one. So can a policy, a delivery norm, a quality specification, or an industry benchmark. In vendor discussions, objective criteria reduce the feeling that it is assertion versus assertion. In procurement, they can reveal differences that do not match what you expected. For example, market price index reporting from the first half of 2025 showed resin prices down 15% and aluminum prices down 9%, yet some supplier quotes did not move in step with those declines. When those gaps appear, centralizing spend analysis can help teams uncover pricing differences above 10% for identical items. Those numbers matter because they let you replace a vague feeling with a standard you can both inspect. The goal is not to argue louder. The goal is to tie the discussion to a measure. From there, the conversation turns to your alternatives with BATNA. BATNA stands for the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. It is what you will do if no deal happens. It is the option that stands behind the current conversation. That might mean a different vendor, a different repair service, a delay you can tolerate, another job opportunity, or walking away. A strong BATNA gives you freedom. You can reject a poor proposal without panic. A weak BATNA leaves you exposed because the fear of having no plan makes many offers feel tempting, even when they are not good for you. The goal is not to pretend every alternative is equally good. The goal is to know which alternative you can actually access and how good it really is. With BATNA defined, the reservation point and the zone of possible agreement become easier to place. Your reservation point is the lowest acceptable deal, the line where the arrangement is worse than your BATNA. If the other side's reservation point sits above yours, there may be room for agreement. If it sits below yours, overlap becomes more likely. That overlap is the zone of possible agreement, or ZOPA, the range where both sides can say yes without being worse off than they would be apart. In plain terms, BATNA helps you decide when to walk. Your reservation point tells you where your floor sits. ZOPA tells you whether those floors and ceilings overlap at all. When you understand these ideas together, negotiation becomes a decision you can run, not guesswork you endure. Underpreparing weakens all of that. If you have not worked through your alternatives, your market facts, the tradable issues, and the other side's likely limits, you either concede too early or demand too much. That is where unnecessary losses come from. You might give up price when you could trade for timing. You might accept a shorter contract than you need when a longer term could satisfy both sides. You might step back from a salary conversation because the first pushback feels bigger than it really is. Preparation is not decoration. It is what keeps a mediocre deal from turning into a bad one. The more clearly you know your limits and the other side's probable range, the less likely you are to confuse discomfort with danger. In work settings, preparation also means widening the frame beyond the headline number. Client pricing is rarely only about the fee. It often includes scope, turnaround time, revision limits, payment timing, and the level of support after delivery. Vendor renewals often turn on similar questions. Can you match the renewal to real market movement? And what concessions are actually worth trading? Procurement teams may need to compare quotes, test whether increases reflect market change, and decide which compromises protect total outcomes, not just immediate cost. Scope changes reveal the cost of vague language once work has already started, because clarity on what is included affects time, budget, and risk. Even team resource negotiations are usually about priorities. A manager may want a project started immediately, but the deeper issue may be whether another deadline must move first. When those trade-offs get brought into the open, there is often more room to maneuver than opening positions suggest. You can also think of negotiation as both a conversation and a design problem. The conversation asks what each side wants. The design problem asks how to arrange those wants so the outcome makes sense. That is why objective criteria, BATNA, reservation point, and ZOPA belong together. They keep the conversation from collapsing into pressure alone. In strong negotiations, each side is clear about its own floor, realistic about the other side's floor, and honest about the kinds of trades that are actually available. That clarity does not eliminate tension. It makes tension usable. Culture further shapes what clarity looks like. Directness, hierarchy, silence, and time pressure do not mean the same thing everywhere. In some settings, a direct refusal can sound efficient and respectful. In others, it can land as blunt. Hierarchy may require the senior person to speak first or make the final call in some organizations, while shared authority is expected in others. Silence can signal careful thought, discomfort, disagreement, or simple courtesy. Time pressure can be urgency in one market and an insult in another. If you ignore these differences, you can misread the room. The better habit is to observe the local pattern, ask clean questions, and adapt without losing your purpose. Confidence in negotiation should come from options, not from pressure. Pressure may sound forceful in the moment, but it rarely builds trust or creates durable value. Options do. When you know what else you can do, you can slow down, ask for clarification, compare one offer against another, and resist a rush to settle. That kind of confidence matters most when the other side tries to set the tempo. A rushed negotiator often gives away more just to reduce tension. A prepared negotiator can stay calm because the alternative is already understood. Finally, negotiation matters beyond the immediate deal because it sets expectations. A clear agreement states what will happen, when it will happen, and what counts as acceptable. That reduces the chance that later conversations turn into arguments about assumptions that were never stated. In everyday life, it can mean agreeing on who handles a repair, when a task is due, and what the subscription includes. In business, it can mean defining scope, service levels, payment terms, and renewal conditions before friction starts. Good negotiation turns uncertainty into terms, and terms into a working pattern that holds up when reality arrives. Seen this way, negotiation is less about winning a moment and more about building a workable agreement. You start with what is at stake, you understand what you can trade, and you learn to tell the difference between a position and an interest. With that foundation in place, the next step is turning these ideas into preparation you can use before the meeting starts. That same 2025 reporting gives a concrete test of how objective standards can surface mismatches in procurement conversations. Preparation is the strongest predictor of whether a negotiation feels manageable or chaotic. Before the meeting begins, the most useful work is not persuasion. It is sorting what truly matters. If a higher salary, a lower renewal price, or a faster delivery date is the outcome you cannot miss, put it in the must-have column. If a better payment schedule, a wider service package, or a longer warranty would be welcome but not essential, put it in the nice-to-have column. If something can be traded without damaging the core result, it belongs in the bargaining material. Beginners often treat every request as equal. Skilled negotiators do not. They know that clarity at the start prevents confusion later, when pressure is already in the room. That clarity also has to exist inside your own organization before you speak to the other side. If you walk in without knowing who can approve what, you are already negotiating with one hand tied. Decision authority matters because a conversation can look promising and still fail if the person speaking cannot commit. Deadlines matter for the same reason. A renewal that must close by the end of the quarter is not the same as one that can wait another month. Internal stakeholders matter too, because their priorities shape what you can promise. Finance may care about cash flow, operations may care about continuity, and a manager may care about speed. If those views are not aligned in advance, you carry a divided position into the room. Good preparation also means gathering facts that keep the conversation anchored in reality. Market rates, supplier costs, budget limits, and available alternatives are not background noise. They are the ground the agreement has to stand on. In procurement, that may mean checking what comparable suppliers charge, what a service should cost, or whether a requested increase tracks with recent input changes. In client pricing, it may mean understanding how similar projects are priced, what the scope really requires, and where your own cost structure starts to tighten. In salary talks, it may mean knowing the market range for the role, the value of the responsibilities, and the trade-offs that matter most to the employer. Facts do not guarantee agreement, but they make bluffing much harder. The same discipline applies to the person across the table. A beginner often focuses only on personal needs, when a better question is what the other side is trying to protect. Their interest may be budget control, speed, certainty, reputation, convenience, or risk reduction. Their constraint may be a quarterly target, a fixed procurement policy, a client promise, or an internal approval chain. Their BOT-NA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, is what they will do if no deal is reached. Their reservation point is the point below which walking away is better than accepting the offer. When you estimate those limits in advance, you stop guessing at what the other person can accept and start reading the shape of the deal. That reading becomes more powerful when you separate issues that can be bundled from issues that cannot. Not every disagreement has to be solved one point at a time. In many negotiations, the better move is to link issues into a package. Price can be traded against volume. Volume can be traded against payment terms. Service levels can be traded against contract length. Delivery speed can be traded against flexibility. Commitment can be traded against price protection. The point of packaging is not to blur the deal, it is to create room. If one side values cash flow more than a small discount, or the other side, pawn, values ayasa certainty more than a modest margin gain, a package can turn a narrow argument into a workable exchange. Objective criteria help that package hold together. A fair conversation about price, scope, service, quality, timing, and risk needs standards both sides can point to. A market benchmark is one standard. A delivery norm is another. A quality specification, a service level target, an industry index, or a written policy can all serve the same purpose. Without standards, negotiations slide toward personality. One side says the price is too high. The other says it is justified. One side says the scope is reasonable. The other says it is bloated. Objective criteria do not remove disagreement. They make disagreement testable. In procurement, that matters when market conditions move faster than old contracts do. In the first half of 2025, market price index reporting showed resin prices down 15% and aluminum prices down 9%. Yet some supplier quotes did not move with those declines. Centralized spend analysis can also surface price differences above 10% for identical items. That is exactly the kind of gap objective criteria are meant to expose. A vague suspicion becomes a measurable question. Why does this quote sit where it does, and what part of the price still reflects real cost? Once you have the facts, the sequence of the negotiation matters more than many beginners realize. The order in which issues appear changes what feels negotiable. If the first subject is the most emotional one, the room may harden too soon. If the first subject is the easiest one, momentum can build. If a difficult issue waits until the end, it may be easier to resolve after some trust has formed. Planning the sequence before the meeting lets you choose the path instead of drifting into it. In a client pricing discussion, you may begin with scope and expected turnaround before talking about fee. In a vendor renewal, you may review service performance before revisiting price. In a team resource request, you may establish workload and deadline before arguing about who gets help. That same planning helps you decide whether to make the first offer. The first serious number or reference point often shapes the rest of the conversation. Anchoring is the reason. People compare later numbers to the first number that feels meaningful, even when they know it is only a starting point. If you know the range better than the other side does, opening first can be an advantage. If the other side knows the market better, waiting may be wiser. In a salary conversation, a candidate may have less information than the employer, so it can make sense to ask about the range before naming a number. In a client pricing conversation, a service provider who knows the real cost structure and market norms may gain by opening first with a confident figure. The key is not automatic first mover instinct. The key is information. When you do open first, the shape of the number matters. Precise figures often carry more force than round ones because they sound researched rather than improvised. A request for $108,500 can feel more grounded than $110,000. A renewal at 9.7% can feel more deliberate than a flat 10%. Precision signals that there is a basis behind the number, and it gives the other side less room to assume you made it up. The point is not to sound clever. The point is to show that the anchor is informed. Range offers can work too when they are used carefully. A range is a firm opening with room to move, and it often feels less abrasive than a single hard number. A supplier might ask for $70,000 to $75,000 rather than only $75,000. A contractor might propose a delivery window rather than an absolute date. A compensation discussion might name a salary band rather than a single figure. The range still anchors the conversation, but it leaves space for reciprocity. The choice of when to open first is tied to context. In client pricing, opening first may be wise when you understand the scope better than the client does. In vendor renewals, it can make sense if you have hard market data and want to establish the frame. In procurement, the side with the stronger data position often benefits from moving first. In salary negotiations, waiting may be smarter when the employer holds the range and you lack reliable information. A first offer is not just a number. It is a message about confidence, knowledge, and the range of possible agreement. That is why the decision should be deliberate. Listening well matters just as much as opening well. Active listening is not passive silence. It is paraphrasing, inquiry, and acknowledgement. Paraphrasing means restating the message in your own words to test whether you understood it. If a client says the fee is too high, you might respond that the concern is not only price but whether the proposal fits the approved budget. That is not agreement. It is a check for meaning. Inquiry means asking questions that uncover the reason behind the demand or objection. If someone says the offer is unacceptable, the useful follow-up is not a speech. It is a question that reveals whether the problem is price, scope, timing, risk, or trust. Acknowledgement means naming the concern or frustration on without agreeing to the underlying claim. You can say the other side sounds frustrated by the price, or uneasy about the timeline, without conceding that the price is unfair or the timeline impossible. People who feel ignored often harden. People who feel recognized are more likely to stay in the conversation. Used well, these habits reveal what kind of problem is actually in the room. A price objection may really be a scope objection. A scope objection may really be a trust objection. A timing objection may really be about internal approval or staffing. The wrong fix can make things worse. Cutting price may not solve a concern about reliability. Expanding scope may not solve a concern about budget. Slowing delivery may not solve a concern about ownership. The question underneath the objection is often the real negotiation. Body language gives more clues, but you should read it carefully. In person, posture, head tilt, eye contact, nodding, and natural mirroring can all signal attention. A slight forward lean and a gentle head tilt usually communicate curiosity. Calm nodding suggests understanding. Eye contact that feels natural, not intense, tends to support trust. Too much staring can feel like pressure. Too little can feel like disengagement. A handshake and greeting can also matter where they are culturally appropriate, because they create a small opening of goodwill. These cues help the conversation feel human. They are not magic. They simply reduce friction at the start. The same caution applies on video calls, where the body is partly hidden and attention has to be communicated differently. Camera-centered focus matters because it creates the feeling of direct address. Facial cues matter because the face carries much of the emotional signal in a remote meeting. A slight lean toward the camera can show engagement. Brief pauses can signal that the other person has space to finish. Even here, the goal is not performance. It is clarity. Remote negotiation gets harder when the small signals of attentiveness disappear, so you replace them with deliberate attention. Still, nonverbal cues alone do not prove honesty. A relaxed posture can sit beside a misleading statement. A firm handshake does not guarantee good faith. A warm face can hide a poor offer. Experienced negotiators do not use body language as a lie detector. They combine it with precise questions and consistency checks. If a claim matters, ask about it more than once in slightly different ways. Compare answers across the conversation. Look for whether the story stays stable. That approach is slower than judging by appearance, but it is safer. Your style shapes how all of this feels. A collaborative style looks for trades that improve both sides' outcomes. It works best when the relationship matters and when the issues can be exchanged across several dimensions. A competitive style focuses on leverage and protecting your own result. It can be useful when the other side is pushing hard or when the negotiation is narrow and one-sided. An adaptive style moves between the two, becoming more collaborative when the other side is open and more firm when the situation requires it. None of these styles is automatically right in every case. The important thing is to match the style to the stakes, the relationship, and the facts. Multi-issue bargaining is where a collaborative or adaptive style often earns its keep. Price, volume, payment terms, service, delivery, and commitment can all be traded against one another. A buyer may accept a slightly higher unit price in exchange for better payment terms or stronger service guarantees. A supplier may accept tighter pricing in exchange for volume certainty. A client may accept a broader scope if the timeline is more flexible. A manager may approve a resource request if the project plan is clearer and the deadline is realistic. The more issues there are, the more likely it is that each side values the package differently. That difference creates room for trade. That same logic fits a modern hybrid negotiation. In-person meetings can be useful for relationship building, especially at the beginning of a difficult or important exchange. Remote sessions then work well for detailed work, red lines, revisions, and fact-checking. That split saves time and preserves energy. It also recognizes that trust and detail often need different settings. A face-to-face opening can make later remote discussion easier because the relationship already has some texture, and then the practical work can move forward without carrying the cost of a long single meeting. Emotional intelligence sits underneath all of these choices. Negotiation is not only a math problem. It is also a human exchange under pressure. Noticing emotion, naming it clearly, and managing your own reaction can keep a conversation from derailing. If the other side sounds irritated, that irritation may be about the current offer or about something that happened before the meeting. If your own frustration rises, it can push you toward rushing, withdrawing, or over-explaining. Emotional intelligence helps you slow down long enough to separate the emotion from the substance. That does not mean becoming soft. It means staying accurate when the room gets heated. Data-driven procurement methods are a good example of that blend of analysis and restraint. A should-cost model asks what a product or service ought to cost based on inputs, labor, logistics, and margin, rather than accepting the supplier's first number as final. Spend consolidation brings related purchases together, so patterns become visible. Index-linked pricing ties part of the price to a benchmark, so changes follow a formula instead of a fight. These tools matter because they reduce noise. They also help buyers and suppliers talk about real inputs instead of guessing at each other's motives. When used well, they turn a tense price discussion into a more structured comparison. That structure shows up in everyday negotiations, too. In a vendor renewal, a prepared buyer may separate service quality from headline price and then use market data to ask whether the increase is justified. In a client pricing discussion, a service provider may explain what is included, what is optional, and what is tradable before naming a precise fee. In a scope change, the key move may be to clarify what new work has been added and which deadline or budget has to adjust with it. In a procurement conversation, a team may compare alternative suppliers, total cost of ownership, and index movement before deciding whether to stay or switch. In a team resource request, the real negotiation may be about priorities rather than people. In a salary discussion, the same principles apply. Know the range, know the value, and know the alternative. The through line is simple. Preparation does not just make you look organized. It gives you choices. It lets you decide whether to open first, what number to use, which issues to bundle, how to respond to resistance, and when to ask more questions instead of offering more concessions. It also keeps the conversation grounded in facts rather than feelings alone. Once that groundwork is laid, the negotiation itself becomes easier to steer because the deal is no longer just a demand and a response. It is a set of informed trades made in a clear sequence with a clearer view of what each side can truly accept. From there, the next challenge is learning how to handle pressure when the other side starts pushing, stalling, or testing the limits of the room. Once you have prepared, pressure is where the method proves itself. A calm discussion with a cooperative counterpart can make anyone look skilled. The harder test comes when the other side opens with an extreme number, an ultimatum, a long silence meant to unsettle you, or a deadline designed to force a decision before the facts are clear. At that point, your job is not to win the mood in the room. Your job is to keep the agreement tied to facts, limits, and trade-offs. Extreme opening numbers work because they try to reset the frame. A supplier names a price well above market. A client offers a fee far below the work required. A manager asks for a project by tomorrow when the work clearly needs more time. The tactic is simple. Accept this starting point, or spend your energy trying to prove you deserve to stay in the conversation. The useful response is not panic. It is pace. A long silence is not an emergency, and a pause gives you time to think. Ultimatums and deadlines often work the same way. They make time feel scarce, so judgment gets softer. Some deadlines are real, but pressure tactics try to make every deadline sound final. The better move is to slow the tempo and ask for the basis. Why does that number make sense? What changed? What assumption sits behind the deadline? Once the conversation moves from pressure to explanation, the room usually becomes easier to read. That distinction matters because a hard tactic is not always the same thing as a hard person. Someone may sound aggressive because the opening move is aggressive, not because every part of the relationship is broken. Separating the person from the problem helps you stay precise. The question is not whether the other side is difficult in some permanent sense. The question is whether the current demand can be justified, adjusted, or traded against something else. One of the most useful moves under pressure is to restate the issue without accepting the other side's frame. If a vendor says an increase is unavoidable, you do not have to accept inevitability. You can restate the issue as a proposed price change that has not yet been connected to costs, service, or market movement. If a client says the fee is too high, you do not have to argue about fairness. You can restate the problem as a question about scope, timing, budget, or expected level of support. Whoever defines the problem first often shapes the path of the discussion. Asking for the basis of a number is especially powerful because it forces a shift from assertion to explanation. The same 2025 market data offers a clear benchmark here. In that reporting, resin prices are down 15% and aluminum prices are down 9%. Yet some supplier quotes do not move with those declines. That gap gives you a concrete question. What part of the price still reflects current input cost, and what part reflects an older assumption? Objective criteria make that question stronger because they move the discussion away from personality. A should-cost model helps from another angle by asking what a product or service ought to cost once labor, materials, logistics, and margin are accounted for. Centralized spend analysis can also surface price differences above 10% for identical items. That kind of spread is not just a bookkeeping detail. It gives you a basis for challenge, and it changes the burden of proof. The same logic matters in vendor renewals, where pressure often arrives in a quieter form. A contract is about to roll over, and the supplier presents a higher rate as though continuity should settle the matter. But a renewal is not a favor. It is a new agreement. If the old contract includes an indexation clause, you still need to check whether the formula tracks the right inputs. In multi-year contracts, indexation can drift away from actual cost movement over time. A clause can go stale even when neither side intends that outcome. Scope creep creates a different kind of pressure. The work expands, but the time, price, or priority does not. That imbalance is one of the most common sources of strain in client relationships and internal projects. A request that begins with a narrow deliverable can quietly collect extra revision rounds, more stakeholders, more formats, more reporting, and more last-minute changes. If the added work is real, the agreement has to change with it. More scope means time must expand, cost must rise, or another priority has to give way. Inside a team, the same problem usually appears as a capacity trade-off. A manager wants help immediately. A team member is already committed elsewhere. Finance wants lower spend, while operations wants faster delivery. These are not moral failures. They are limits. Negotiation gets clearer when the request is translated into a priority decision. If this project moves up, what moves back? If this task takes the top slot, what gets delayed? Clear trade-offs protect a team from hidden overload, which is often just scope creep wearing an internal mask. Concession planning makes these moments less dangerous because it keeps you from improvising under pressure. Before the meeting starts, you decide what can be traded, what cannot, and what each concession should buy in return. A concession ladder helps because it makes movement deliberate. The first concession is small and low cost. The next one requires a meaningful exchange. The final concession appears only if the other side gives something equally important. Without that structure, people often give away value just to keep the conversation moving. The best concessions are often the ones that cost little but matter a great deal to the other side. Timing can matter more than price. Payment terms can matter more than a small discount. A delivery window can matter more than a few points of margin. References, testimonials, communication commitments, and scheduling flexibility can all carry real value while costing less than a direct price cut. In service work, a client may care deeply about one extra revision cycle. In procurement, a vendor may care more about volume certainty than about a modest shift in terms. In a salary conversation, a hiring manager may respond more to a start date or review timing than to a small change in base pay. That exchange has to stay balanced. A deal starts to tilt when concessions move in only one direction and reciprocity never arrives. Another warning sign is vague appreciation without any movement. A third is quiet escalation, where the other side keeps asking for more as though the last concession never happened. When that pattern appears, the question changes. It is no longer how to keep the conversation comfortable. It is whether the agreement still beats your alternative. That is where BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, comes back into focus. BATNA is the line that keeps a bad deal from becoming your default answer. If the offer drops below that line, or if the concessions required to reach agreement destroy the value of the deal, walking away may be the right move. Stopping is not failure when the terms no longer make sense. It is discipline. It also protects you from sunk cost thinking, the habit of staying in a poor conversation simply because you have already spent time on it. If you know when to stop, you are usually the one who prepared well enough to compare options honestly. That comparison matters in commercial settings. A procurement team may have one supplier with a long relationship and another with better current pricing. A client may want continuity, but the current scope may no longer justify the old fee. An employee may want to stay in a role, but the offer may no longer reflect the responsibilities. When the conversation drifts away from objective criteria and toward pressure alone, BATNA becomes the anchor that matters most. When the deal looks close, closing well becomes its own skill. A verbal agreement is not the same thing as a finished agreement. The close should summarize the terms in plain language, confirm that both sides heard the same thing, and set the next step. That means naming the main price or rate, the scope, the timing, any concessions, the approval path, and what happens if a term needs to be revisited. It also means making clear who drafts, who reviews, who signs, when the work or renewal starts, and what counts as acceptance. Written terms matter because memory changes the shape of a deal. After a long negotiation, both sides can honestly remember the same conversation differently. A flexible remark in the room can harden later into a dispute. A written record reduces that drift and makes the agreement easier to execute. In business, that may be a contract, an order form, an email confirmation, or a revised scope document. In everyday life, it may be a text message, a calendar note, or a short written summary. The format matters less than the clarity. That record should then feed an after-action review. Good negotiators do not only close deals, they study them. Which opening move helped? Which question uncovered the real issue? Which concession created movement? Which benchmark carried the most weight? What part of the conversation stayed clear, and what part became muddy? Over time, that habit matters more than any single tactic because it turns one outcome into a repeatable method. The review also reveals patterns across settings. In a vendor renewal, the benchmark may carry the most force. In a client pricing discussion, scope clarity may matter more than the first number. In procurement, should cost analysis and spend consolidation may expose the gap between a quoted price and current conditions. In a team resource request, the decisive issue may be priority rather than persuasion. In a salary conversation or a repair bill, a calm question and a precise counteroffer may do more than pressure ever could. Once those patterns are visible, negotiation stops feeling like improvisation and starts to look like craft. That craft can be expressed as a simple working sequence. You begin with your must-haves, your tradable items, your BATNA, the likely objections, and the standards that can anchor the discussion. You decide whether to open first based on information and leverage, not on reflex. You listen for the gap between the stated demand and the underlying concern. If the first number is aggressive, you bring the conversation back to evidence. You plan concessions as exchanges, not as gifts. Then you close by summarizing the terms and putting the agreement into writing. That sequence applies cleanly across common situations. In a vendor renewal, you can reference service history and market movement, not just loyalty. You ask why the increase is necessary and which cost driver changed. If the supplier cites an index, you compare that index with actual input movement and ask whether the formula still fits. In a client pricing discussion, you define scope before price so the fee rests on a shared understanding of the work. If scope expands, you make clear that the timeline or the budget has to move with it. In both cases, the aim is the same. You prevent a hidden disagreement from masquerading as a simple price fight. In procurement, the same process becomes more data-rich. You compare quotes, test them against should-cost assumptions, and check them against the reporting. If resin is down 15%, and aluminum is down 9%, yet the quote rises, that discrepancy deserves a direct question. If spend analysis shows identical items priced more than 10% apart, you have a basis for consolidation or challenge. If volume certainty can unlock savings, you trade predictability for price instead of chasing a discount alone. These are not tricks. They are ways of making the deal reflect current conditions rather than inertia. In a team resource request, The method is more internal, but not less important. A manager asks for time, attention, or staff. Another project already owns the calendar. The useful move is to surface the capacity trade-off instead of pretending it does not exist. Which deadline moves if this request moves up? What is the cost of delay elsewhere? What can be dropped, narrowed, or postponed? That conversation is often kinder than silent overload, because it makes the constraints visible before they turn into failure. In a service price, repair, or salary discussion, the same discipline still applies. The opening should be clear, the counter should be grounded in facts, and the concessions should be matched to something of value. In a salary conversation, you can ask about the range, the responsibilities, and the review structure before naming a number. In repair work, you can ask what the price includes, whether parts are included, and whether there is a warranty. In a service quote, you can ask what changes if the deadline moves or the scope narrows. A clear question and a calm pause often do more than a show of toughness. Negotiation is not a performance of force. It is a repeatable way to make decisions under competing pressure. The difficult negotiator, the rushed deadline, the expanding scope, and the price that no longer fits the market are all versions of the same test. Can you keep the agreement tied to facts, limits, and trade-offs, rather than to intimidation alone? Can you stay calm enough to ask for the basis of the demand? Can you protect the relationship without losing sight of the problem that needs to be solved? Used this way, negotiation becomes a steady practice of turning pressure into workable terms that both sides can live with. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.